This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, what we really want, the tropes we love in speculative fiction.
Now, this week was suggested by Jules, and I feel like she suggested it completely and only in order to shame me in a conceivable way.
It's more that you inspired me. Madeline and I had an in-depth conversation about a specific trope a while back, and it just kept coming back to me, and I'm like, can we get a Dissecting Dragons episode out without? Like, yeah, of course we can. And then I saw a tweet where someone had said, I just love books about revolutions. It's my favourite trope. And I'm like, yeah, okay, everyone's clearly got their kink here. This is cool. So we're going to talk about some of ours in speculative fiction, not in general life, obviously.
Yeah, I feel like it's very important that we specify that right now. Everything we're talking about is great in fiction, not in real life, okay? Yes. So we're not maniacs. But yeah, I feel like I'm about to be exposed. Though to be honest, anyone who's read any of my work will probably already be very aware of the tropes that I am quite fond of.
Or this will definitely put paid to any doubt whatsoever.
Yeah, you'll reread my work and go, oh yeah.
That's in there. To be fair, the same can be said of me, and a couple of mine are quite embarrassing. I've mentioned some of them before, but I'll be even more open about them this time. So what we're going to do is we are basically going to take a favourite trope and just take it in turns to talk about a favourite trope, basically. The other person will chip in on what they think of this person's favourite trope. And we'll talk about a few examples and then we'll go on to the next one. So it's hopefully a fairly light, fun episode.
Off to some of the more serious ones that we've had quite recently.
Some of them have been a bit intense.
They have. So here we are. So these are the Dissecting Dragons' favourite tropes. And Jules, why don't you kick it off?
Yeah, okay. We have mentioned this one before in our Trading Capes episode, but I love this trope so much it's worth mentioning again. I love it when the hero of a story, particularly if it's a series, starts off as the bad guy. So they basically believe or have been led to believe, or even in some cases have been brainwashed into thinking they're on the side of the good and the righteous, and actually it turns out the whole time that no, they're not, they've been serving the evil overlord. and their entire character journey is moving over to the other side, prompted by some internal moral compass, which they in fairness probably shouldn't have if they've been that badly brainwashed. But yeah, it's a great trope, and obviously a really good example is She-Ra.
Yeah. It's always the Hans, are we the bad guys?
We do have skulls on our helmets.
You're called the Who calls us that? Everybody. I am actually, I also quite like that trope, and you can do a lot with it because it is very interesting both on a physical level and an emotional level for a character, because you've got the very physical thing of, oh god, I've got to get out of here, which usually, you know, requires, usually they get out by accident, realize the truth, and then there's a very physical kind of obstacle for them to get over in order to go to the other side. And then there's the huge emotional turmoil, which is that everything you knew about yourself, about everything, has been wrong. And actually, this trope appears in Captain Marvel.
Yeah, that's true. It does. That's another really good example of it. And I think why it works for me is that it's a really satisfying character journey if it's done right. As in, the character gets this moment where it's like a shatter glass moment where everything they thought they believed in turns out to not be true. And they just basically have to remake themselves from the ground up. You know, what part of me is actually me, what isn't. And that's great fun. Obviously not for the character, but it's great fun for me as the reader or the writer. So I love that one. But yeah, it's really good in Captain Marvel, without any real spoilers, because probably some people haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. But no, it is. It's done very, very well in Captain Marvel. And as you say, in She-Ra, and it's quite a popular trope as well. And I think actually it's also popular because there is a message behind it, which is about perception and about truth and how we can be blinded by what we know and propaganda, which I think is something very relevant.
Yeah.
There
is definitely a message about basically questioning what you're told, not following things just because you've been told them or just because it's easier.
Yeah. And about sort of saying actually there's two sides to everything as well.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah. Okay, let's hear one of yours.
Well, I'm just going to come straight out with it because...
The trope that inspired the episode.
Fevers.
Do you want to be a bit more specific than that?
Okay, well...
Because this is a very niche trope.
This is very... Well, it's kind of born of one particular kind of trope, which is called the brain fever. But I have a thing about feverish men collapsing.
and the rest of it.
Collapsing and weeping and... coming to the near brink of death.
Yes. Basically, if they're in a fever and they're sort of talking in a fever dream about all the traumatic things that have ever happened to them, Madeline's there for that shit.
I am. I'm all over it. I'm like, yeah, give it to me. Come on. Yeah, give me the night terrors. Give me the quiet confessions and the sobbing and the sickness as the friends gather around and gently dab at the... try and lower the fever, but it's no use, he just keeps getting worse. Yeah, I really like it. It's a problem.
Okay, so why do you think you like that one?
I don't know. I think, well, okay, so let me break it down a little bit. The official trope is called the brain fever, and it's in particular it's fevers which have been brought on from stress.
Yeah.
Now, for the most part, you don't actually see it in that much Western literature anymore, because we kind of understand that that's just not really how illness works.
Yeah,
but I mean, at the
we wouldn't even call it a nervous breakdown anymore. You have to use the word psychotic break, which, you know, is it just a departure from reality and in resulting physical sickness to go with it?
Yeah. But you see it in a lot of traditional literature. So Frankenstein, Dracula as well. You get Jonathan Harker, but you also get Frankenstein himself, who after a great shock from stress sort of develop a fever. And Frankenstein is great for it because he literally has his best friend gently nursing him back to health for months. So I'm all over it. But you also see it actually. It's still a very popular trope in Eastern media and Western, Eastern inspired Western media. So, for instance, it happened in Avatar: The Last Airbender, where having made the right choice, he collapses with a fever, which is hilarious to me because he's just there like, God, my entire identity has been stripped away because I didn't do something bad. And he collapses and has a kind of a momentary character change entirely, which is quite interesting because it's meant to be, you know, an emotional thing and a spiritual thing for him, which I quite liked, which is why his body is being so much. It also happens a lot in anime and manga. For instance, Toru from Fruits Basket, you know, when she gets stressed out, she might just develop a fever, as you do. I think the reason I like it is that it's one of these tropes that completely pulls someone apart, but in a way which can still be relatively harmless or in a way which you can come back from.
Yeah.
So unlike something which has a longer consequence, you can just have a short episode with fever, which opens up the well of all of the other, you know, the tropes that we might otherwise like, but which might last you long. So things like madness, things like breaking down, confession, stress, all of these things can be explored with the fever episode.
Yeah.
Because you can have all of it and then actually sort of resolve it and, oh, but the fever stopped. The fever broke. Now they're going to be better. So it's actually quite safe, but also full of all those good things, which I just love to get my hands on.
Yes, because you've used it yourself, haven't you?
I have used it myself. In particular, lots of people develop fevers in Blood of the Delphi. And the reason for that is there is just the sickness going around in general. So they all do just contract the same sickness. It's kind of like the influenza. Rufus gets quite feverish because he's also quite stressed out and gets sort of nursed back to health. And Zachary actually almost dies as well from a fever, which is explored in Blood of the Delphi and Blood, Teeth and Bones. And that was just pure... Blood, Teeth and Bones was just me purely 100% going, I've got to enjoy this a little bit more.
It's like, I read that novella and I was like, I'm enjoying this, but I'm also really put out at Madeline because I think Zachary's been through enough. Like, so I was kind of half pissed off reading it.
I also feel like the reason I like it is because the fever episode, or the kind of, yeah, the brain fever is also a chance of relief for the characters who've been going through a lot emotionally and physically, because it's kind of like a release of all of the bad things at once, and it puts them in a vulnerable position where if they've got, my favourite is when they've got actually people there caring for them. And it's usually in these very vulnerable positions that they're able to finally release some of the things which have been going on inside of them, which is what happens with Zachary as well, in Blood of the Delphi, where he wakes up and is sort of is able to confront Isolde, for instance.
Yeah.
And actually sort of starts to feel a little bit better, until it all goes wrong.
As it does.
So, yeah. So that's mine.
Don't expect a happy ending to Blood of the Delphi, guys, if you haven't read it.
It's a happy ending to any of them.
Okay, one of mine is, I think this is going to be a bit of a moot point for some people, but this is the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And this is a trope that basically explores the birth of an anti-hero. And so you've got somebody who starts off and they're positioned perfectly to be an actual hero in the speculative fiction, whether it's a film or whatever. But one little choice leads to another and then to another and to another. And you may not even recognise the little choice that starts them off in the wrong direction, because they might be doing it genuinely because they think they can make things better, they can improve things. Yeah. And then by the time you get to the end of their character arc, it's like they're like... they're like Al Pacino's character at the end of the Godfather trilogy. You know? They're just blood-soaked psychopaths. And I love that, which obviously makes me sound really weird. But
No, I can completely get it.
But a good example is the traitor Baru Cormorant. Baru Cormorant is a black girl from a little island in a fantasy setting, and the whole thing's a socio-economic fantasy. It's quite intense and it's very dense with meaning. In fact, it's practically gravid with meaning, and it's really, really clever. She's a really clever girl, and she gets the Empire comes to their island and starts colonizing them. And what they do is they take the children and put them in special schools. So they don't take them away from their families, but these children have to be educated at these schools. And then the really promising ones get shipped out to universities where they then get decent positions within the Empire, which is very totalitarian, as examples that, you know, we can even educate the savage, inverted commas. And Baru thinks very early on, because she has two fathers and one mother, they don't like that. So they catch one of her fathers gets caught by the Empire when he's out hunting in the mountains and is horrifically murdered. And she's like, this cannot happen to anybody else. She's only a little girl when she's thinking this. She's like, I'm going to stop this happening. I'm going to game the entire system. I'm going to be the best I can. And somehow I'm going to throw the whole thing down. By the end of the first book, she has I don't want to spoil it, but I want to say that she does not end up doing what she anticipates that she's going to do. And every step of the way, you can then look back and see the little choices she made. And some of the choices she's made have been out of vanity, in the sense of she knows she's really clever. She knows she's cleverer than anyone else. And winning the game becomes an end in its own right, not putting a stop to the ravages of the Empire.
Yeah.
So she ends up as the anti-hero by the end of the first book, to the point where she even puts her own lover to death.
Personally. Okay.
but it's such a good story, and I won't get into the second book, but it goes on from there. You start off the second book where, you know, across the Empire, she is known and feared, as in, do not get on the wrong side of her. But yeah, great book.
Weirdly enough, and I know it's not quite the same, but Lucas kind of almost has a similar sort of thing in Unveiled. It's not quite the same at all, it's like on a much smaller scale. He kind of does start out with the best intentions and sort of becomes quite warped, doesn't he?
Yeah, okay, Madeline's adding in the fact that she's read the novella Lucas Underground, I think.
I have.
And then presumably the short story that happens after all of that as well.
Sorry.
I personally, this is just what I think as the writer, and obviously that doesn't necessarily matter, Roland Barthes style, what I think at the end of the day.
No, don't summon him.
I think you have to say it three times, right? I think by the end of the short story, Eternal Sonata, that Lucas has finally redeemed himself, and that has come about through some character recognition, as in he sees where he was wrong. But you're absolutely right, he's not a nice guy by the end of Lucas Underground.
No, he isn't.
Kind of a shit all the way through the series, right up until the point in I Rule the Night where he just does something really unselfish.
Yeah. No, I think it's why I do quite like, is that, yeah, he does redeem himself and he does recognise where he kind of went wrong, which is quite nice, because I'm a sucker for happy endings at the end of the day. In other people's books, not my own.
Excuse me, well, I'm struck with terror. Okay, please take the mic, Madeline.
So the next one for me is Nightmares, which follows on very nicely from my brain fever.
You just like messing with people's heads, don't you?
I really do. It's a serious problem. I love nightmares and hallucinations and, yeah, the whole kind of the terror thing. And it's used almost constantly. I mean, I think it's one of the most popular tropes that you can have. And in particular, when you have a character who's been traumatized by something, they will have nightmares. And we love it because it's, again, like the fever, it's a very harmless way of exploring the trauma and bringing it back without having to have a strong physical consequence. So, for instance, you can have someone being stabbed over and over and over again, but physically they can still go on. Physically, they can continue to do everything that they were doing before, but it's all inside of them. The pain continues to exist and there's nothing they can do about it. It's completely out of their control.
Yeah.
It's used popular in comic books as well, where they love having the visual. And just an example, I mean, Batman, the nightmare, he often has nightmares which concern the death of his parents, oddly enough. It's the same. Constantine, City of Demons, literally starts with him having sort of nightmares, which kind of end up manifesting. Iron Man, nightmares happens with Wolverine as well. Most of the post-traumatic stress characters suffer from nightmares. It's something that you do as well, Jules?
Yeah, I've got to say that nightmares and dream sequences are the ghost story, gothic fiction, folk horror writer's best friend, because you can get in a bit of backstory and really explore the trauma without having to give people everything and info dump on them.
You do. I mean, I love writing weird and funky dreams as well. Amelia's listening to this, she'll tell you I am all over those dreams.
I can love almost it. Hear Amelia talking about it, to be honest.
Amelia's like, oh yes, it's a Madeleine dream sequence. Because they're always weird and quite funky. Even good dreams are weird and funky. But nightmares are the best. And obviously I also use nightmares a lot in my writing. Rufus is almost continuously suffering from nightmares in Blood of the Delphi. And obviously Jonathan is suffering from terrible nightmares in The Sons of Thestian, which are also, you know, part of the visions that he's having. And I'm pretty sure that I've included nightmares in everything I've ever written, and I'm not going to stop.
Yeah, it's almost like you like traumatizing your characters and then making them dream about it.
I know, it's weird.
Okay, trope that I really enjoy, which is probably quite popular with people in general, is the main character starts from pretty much a position of no power, and through her, well, may as well say her, through her own competence, ultimately, she manages to gain power back for herself. She wins hearts and minds. That's the very particular type of that trope. So if you think Daenerys Targaryen in Game of Thrones, she starts off literally being sold off to a Dothraki horse lord. From there, she, from conquering him, if you like, in a gentle, pliant sort of way, she then wins the loyalty of the entire horde eventually, and then from there goes on to conquer most of the land outside of Westeros. So and not only to conquer it, but by and large to be loved. And okay, yes, a lot of that is propaganda, but there is something to be said for, if you are a conqueror, being able to do it in such a way that you're not crushing people down into the dirt. You actually make them love you. The end is not that they will love you. The end is that they will obey you because it's in their own best interest, because they love you and see you as, you know, as the Messiah, basically. Obviously with Daenerys, that there is a problematic element to that, but if we just take the trope as it stands, just generally, I really like that.
And it is an incredibly popular one. Looking at sort of Eastern media, you see it a fair amount in manga as well, where it's usually one or two, where it's either the I was born the genius and ready to do this, or I had to build my way back up. And I think a very popular example of that is Naruto.
Yeah.
Where his entire premise is that he's not very good, but he wants to be the best. And a very iconic moment is when he's fighting someone who is a genius and manages to defeat him, and the genius literally says, why are you fighting so hard? And he says, because you called me a dropout. And it's, I loved it. It's a very silly anime, and it went on far too long, but my god, it was, the first part was still incredibly iconic. He was a very interesting character who does literally builds up from everybody hating him or looking down on him to being the Hokage, the leader of the entire group, admired and loved by everybody, which is just wonderful.
Yeah, a really niche part of that trope for me is if the character ends up in a situation where everyone around her doesn't speak the same language as her. So part of how she gets them on side is by learning all their languages. And it's just like, that's nerd heaven for me. That really
Yeah, I can totally see that, yeah. That's very cool. Okay, this is my last one of the man torture tropes, which I'm so into.
The fact that you have a list of man torture tropes is a little troubling.
I was looking through a page of tropes and just the sort of the torture and death tropes and going, I like that one, I like that one, I like that one. And I had to really narrow it down, okay? So this is one I called Fake It Till You Break It. Which is a kind of a subversion of the secret stab wound trope.
Oh, that one. Where,
I love it so much. Where someone has been hurt, and I I'll use fake it till you break it rather than secret stab wound, because it can be hurt physically or it can be hurt emotionally. So someone who's suffered a terrible trauma, or someone who's been stabbed or shot and hasn't informed their comrades or anyone else about it. They're just pretending like everything is okay, and they're denying the fact that the reality of what's happening until the point that they physically stand anymore, or they just break down. And Jules knows I like this one because I begged her to write a story where she does this to Kieran.
You can tell when Madeline loves a character, really, really loves a character, because she'll ask you to hurt them a lot, a lot, a lot.
No, just be like, I love this character. Now bring them down.
It's like that whole sort of, can you just read this bit of Betwixt and Between for me? It's like, yeah, that's great. I think Kieran should get hurt. I'm like, are you kidding? He nearly gets redacted. And Madeline's like, not nearly redacted enough. So like, oh my god, what do you want?
What do you want this to go?
Well, it worked, because yeah. Another reader was pretty traumatized by that. So.
That's exactly what I want to hear. I did the exact same thing for Amelia, again, for one of her pieces of work, where, again, redacted, something happens, and I went, oh, do this, and she was like, that's horrible, and I'm like, trust me. And then she got feedback as well, people going, say thank you to your friend for making you do that. So there you go. I'm not the only one who enjoys it. But yeah, it's the taking the whole world and trying to carry the burden alone, and then, but not being able to, physically not being able to, due to the emotional, or the physical toil. And again, it definitely appears with quite, a few characters, and it's usually linked in with a sudden collapse, which no one expects, which again, I'm all over. And then you can go straight into the brain fever. So, ta-da!
That's like a double whack. That's you done, isn't it? You know, that's everything you want right there.
We go. I go, fake it till you break it, when they collapse, have a brain fever, where they start having nightmares. It's my dream come true.
I will write you some fan fiction. You wait. I will see if I can even shock you.
You have shocked me. There are certain things that you did to a certain character of mine that have shocked me. Anyway.
Okay, one moving away from torture.
Now
there's this probably has a different name. I wasn't as studious as Madeline, and I didn't look up all these tropes to see if they had names. I've just named them myself.
I've named some, but yeah, go on.
This is the one that I call kitchen heroes, and basically what I mean by that is not the main character, not the chosen one, the really heroic people who sort of stand behind them, and they make sure that the bread gets baked, that everybody gets home safely, that the horses are fed and watered, that the armies get paid, etc, etc. And I don't think they're given nearly enough credit, to the point where in another novella, which is part of Dead Roads, I've actually given Nick Alden, Grace's boyfriend, a bit more page time so that you can see that actually he's a really, really decent bloke. And he is basically one of these kitchen heroes.
He is. I was going to say he's the ultimate kitchen hero, because everyone else is like, we must fight the hellhound and the dead. And he's like, but have you eaten? No, thank you.
Yeah, he's like, he's organising people into shifts to sleep so that nobody's too exhausted to be able to carry on with what they're doing. And he talks Kieran down. He's just really, really good. And, yeah. And then when it comes down to taking down the hellhound, Nick just sort of casually walks up.
Yeah, he's a very unassuming hero, but he's kind of a linchpin character, because without him, nothing else would function. Or worse yet, without these characters, these kitchen heroes, what happens is that the heroes, the chosen, manage to succeed and win the day, but when they come back, there's nothing to come back to.
Yeah.
And the kitchen heroes are kind of the ones who are making sure that there is something to come back to, that there is that baseline, and that everyone is being held together, because otherwise they would fall apart. And in some ways, characters like Samwise Gamgee.
Yeah, that kind was of my next example.
yeah, the ultimate kitchen heroes.
Yeah.
And very important. And you're right, they just don't get enough love.
So a really, really good kitchen hero. I'm like, sort of, yeah, shove the MC to one side. It's like, I want to hear more about this character. This character is great. This character is just lovely. And I think Nick might be the nicest character I've ever written. He, like, literally the nicest bloke I've ever written.
Yeah. It's really funny because he was taken over by Hayes. And when I say, I don't mean funny. I mean totally tragic.
Tragic and ironic. I should probably at some point go back and explore why that happened. I do know, but I've never explained it.
Oh. You're never leaving the unveiled verse.
Oh god.
It's no, got you okay, by the
I
neck.
Won't go back and do it. I won't do it.
You will. Right, okay, so the next trope that I love, and finally we're moving away from the torture for now. Is Jerk with a Heart of Gold, with the inclusion of the soft character who breaks their hard exterior. I am all over this. I love it. And usually sometimes it can be the main character, but usually it's a mentor character. But I mean, there are plenty of examples. On the one side, you have Batman and Robin, who are a classic example of Batman is a bit of a jerk, to be honest. He's not very nice, particularly with other people his age, particularly with other leaguers. He can be quite rude and abrasive and cold, which is why watching him on his own, I don't usually like him. But when he is given another character to play off of, when we're allowed to see his softer side, he becomes an incredibly endearing character. And there are lots of ways of doing this. One way is with the inclusion of children, because he's actually he's not good with children, but he makes efforts with children, and you get to see his softer side. So with the inclusion of Robin, or with the inclusion of Clark Kent, for instance, when Clark is being the soft one, yeah. Which he is sometimes because he's quite jolly. But also the innocent one, whilst Bruce Wayne is acerbic and jaded. Another great example is Kaz Brekker and Inej from Six of Crows.
Yeah, the thing about Kaz that's so great is the fact he's kind of like really surly, you're all just my tools, but I would die for any one of you.
Yeah, he's just there like, you mean nothing to me, put a jumper on, it's cold outside. Yeah, he would, you see it in the action, he would actually die for his crew. And he demonstrates that time and time again, whilst citing one thing. I mean, it's what I kind of tried to do with Zachary, and failed because he just turned out to be less and less of a jerk the more I wrote him. But he's still a giant dick. And he did eat a few people, so that's definitely something that is quite jerk worthy, I guess. But he is actually quite soft, and he is all threats, but his action is obviously don't match up with that. And when put in the position where he's got to take care of a child or a woman or someone in his care, he demonstrates actually that softness, which otherwise he hides away. But yeah, usually you will find this character in sort of a mentor. And so in particular, you'll see it, you know, the police chief or the superior officer, who is very hard to the newbie, but turns out to actually be quite fair in their judgment, and quietly and secretly encouraging, like Dr. Cox from Scrubs, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay, sort of leading on from that one, this is probably my most dicey one in some respects. I really love a good space cowboy character as well. So on one hand, I've got like, I love kitchen heroes, they don't get enough screen time. And on the other hand, it's like, yeah, give me Han Solo. Seriously. You know?
Han Solo. Mal Reynolds.
Yeah, and all the people who sort of fall into that sort of bracket, and the idea is, you know, they really are quite self-involved. They're genuinely self-involved. They're not just citing the fact that, oh, I don't care about anyone else. Their survival has depended on them not really caring about anyone else. And right up until the last minute, you're kind of like, no, they really are that self-involved. And then they'll turn around and go, ah, fuck it, I guess I'll come and help you blow up the Death Star anyway, you know?
Exactly.
But in some ways, they are highly questionable characters, particularly, I mean, if you look at Han Solo and Mal Reynolds particularly, it's really clear that they care about the women that they're sort of paired off with or going to be paired off with. But having said that, the way they show this is by constantly questioning them and demeaning them all the way, right up until the point where it's a case of, oh, she does like me back, then I guess I'll stop calling her a whore or whatever, you know?
Yeah, which is,
which is why it's a problematic one, but it's a case of, no, I still love me a good space cowboy.
Yeah, no, I completely appreciate that. It's lovable scoundrels, you just can't, you love to hate them, or rather, you hate to love them. Okay, next one that I really love is the genius in their field trope.
Yes.
So this is the total opposite of the built up from nothing idea, which is when you have a character who is just can go above and beyond the expectation in a particular field which interests them, either because they have a kind of a link to the thing, or it's just something that they happen to be good at. And, you know, that means that they're the expert in that area, usually above other people. And I love characters like that. I mean, some fine, very obvious examples are Tony Stark from Iron Man.
Yep.
You know, he's a genius when it comes to mechanics and things like that. He is able to just pick up skills very quickly, and his intelligence is endearing. You know, he's this mechanic who can build pretty much anything, to the point that, you know, they say they've got this team of scientists trying to replicate his work, and they just don't understand how he was able to do it in this cave alone whilst dying as a prisoner. So I love that. Other examples, Edward Elric from Full Metal Alchemist. He's a massive bookworm, very, very interested in alchemy. It's kind of inherited, both he and his brother have inherited this ability from their father, who is again also a very intelligent alchemist. And some of their knowledge is also because they have been given forbidden knowledge, which Ed literally sacrificed an arm and a leg for. Literally sacrificed an arm and a leg, and which has given him this amazing knowledge, which means that he can understand things on a level that other people don't. It's more instinctual. You see it with crime as well. Artemis Fowl and Kaz Brekker.
Yeah.
These two criminal geniuses who, I love it because it's like they're thieves, but there's something classy about them. I say classy about them. Kaz Brekker is literally called Dirty Hands. He's the most unclassy person ever. But there is, it's smart crime. Similarly, Locke Lamora, smart crime, where you kind of, you're doing really bad things, but because you've been so smart about it, and because you're so good at understanding human nature and things like that, we can't look away, and I love it. And then on the bright side of things, you have people who are geniuses in magic. So characters like Callum from The Dragon Prince never did magic before, and just suddenly finds that he's got a real, real knack for it. And kind of found his place when he couldn't really succeed in anything else, and it's quite natural to him, so much so that he's able to achieve something that no one else has, no other human has ever done before. And I obviously use this trope as well, because that's Rufus. He's this genius of magic where he understands it on an instinctual level. It's not just numbers, and he doesn't have to figure it out. It's already there, and I just find it incredibly endearing, and I really like it.
was going to say, you are going to love Melanie Beckett then, because going back to the whole sort of genius of crime thing, it's like, yep, that's going to be your wheelhouse.
I've met Melanie Beckett once, and I already love Melanie Beckett, so, you know. Yeah, I do love that, the natural, and then it's in particular, it's they're a genius within their area, not necessarily in everything. And it's very different from just the genius, like someone like Sherlock from Sherlock, where he sort of seems to be a genius at absolutely everything in every area, and
Or any of the sort of American, usually American drama type characters. Like, I do science. Like, what kind of science? Oh, I do everything. Really? Do you know how big the field of science is? You'd have to live for hundreds of years to be able to be an expert at every single part of it.
Yeah. It's like, you know, and it's Dr. Brennan from Bones, for instance, as well. She's a genius in that particular area. And that's what she knows, and that's what she does, and people come to her for that. So
also Amy with physics is her wheelhouse, you know.
Exactly. And Emily, the dead.
Yeah, I'm not sure she'd call that genius. More kind of like, yeah, this is kind of a life and death job. I can't quit, so thanks. I want to speak to the creator.
Yeah, I do wonder what would happen if our characters were forced to listen to this episode on tropes and being like, this explains so much, the bastards.
Just Em and Kes would be just like, the fuckers planned all of this. Okay, moving away from the genius, another one I really like is the unlikely or unassuming love interest. As in, okay, this is going to be difficult to explain, but particularly because I don't want to spoil Madeline for Deep Space Nine, because I'm hoping she's going to watch all of it and we can completely geek out over the whole thing. You know, I'm really holding out hope for this. Okay, for example, if you take Odo. Odo is basically a polymorph. He can, not in the Red Dwarf sense, but he's a shapeshifter, shape changer, and his species find out about other species in the universe by basically just catapulting their young into space and seeing how other species react to them, which is horrible. It's really horrible. Odo was found by a Bajoran scientist, and he didn't have a great start. The Bajoran had to get funding for his science project. He'd found Odo, knew Odo was basically a shape change. Well, he didn't know he was a shape changing character, but he knew it was a living organism, but he had to get him to react to something. So because Odo was just a gelatinous blob at the time, he was a child, so he just basically tortures Odo into holding shapes, and Odo's quite bitter about this years and years later, understandably. Even his name in Bajoran means unknown sample. So it's really bad.
Rude.
Anyway, getting back to the whole unassuming love interest thing, Odo falls absolutely head over heels for Major Kira. And for like, I think it's for something like six entire seasons, you just see Kira going out with various different people and Odo being there, being the best friend, waiting in the rings, and it absolutely kills you. But it's amazing at the same time. And so, obviously, I don't want to spoil it for you, but because you have to watch this, Madeline, you just have to.
Okay.
So that. For example, or the other example, which people are going to go, what? That's a real leap from Star Trek, is the Rescuers and the Rescuers Down Under, where you've got Bernard, who's quite a rotund mouse, and he spends all of the Rescuers Down Under trying to pluck up the courage to propose to his partner, Bianca, and just being really nervous and getting like thrown off every single time. So, you know, just sort of genuinely values the other character for themselves, not for any other reason, wants them to be happy and ends up suffering quite a lot because of it. And again, you know, kind of Nick as well.
Yeah, absolutely, Nick. You know, it makes me think of A History of Dragons.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
Do you mean the Mary Brennan ones?
Yes.
The Natural History of Dragons.
Yeah, that's it.
I've read the first one.
Yeah. In A Natural History of Dragons, and I can't, it was about a year ago since I read it, and I cannot remember the characters' names. You have the the main character Isabella, and she gets married, and her husband, it's sort of an arranged marriage, and they're quite close, and weirdly enough, I actually really liked their relationship because they sort of fall in love. And the thing I liked about it is that they do start off as friends. And her husband, despite the fact it's very unconventional, says, okay, you're interested in this area. I'm going to support you. And he does support her, and he's gentle and loving and quite nice. And we talked about it in our book group, and everyone was, oh yeah, we just found it really boring. We were glad, you know, spoilers. He dies. Like, we were glad he died. And I was like, really? I thought it was actually a really nice relationship. And I think we're quite spoiled in fiction where you have these whirlwind romances, you know, again, as much as I love it, but, you know, the Resands of the world, the Court of Thorns and Roses comes flying in and just goes, it's got to be like heart-stoppingly... you know, blood pumpingly passionate. And I'm like, but actually I quite liked that they were friends, and actually they started that, you know, they built it up from there, and they started to develop this relationship which was based on mutual respect and interest, which developed into love. And everyone was really dismissive of it, like, oh, it wasn't really love. Just think, why? Because he was just quite gentle and just encouraging. I don't understand why it wasn't love. So yeah, that makes me think of it.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. That does feed into one of my other tropes, but it's your turn first, so
yeah. Okay, so the next one I really like is the brains and the brawn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is when you have these characters who you have the character who's there to be the strong man, and then you have the character who comes up with the schemes and the plans. Usually you will, you know, you usually see it when you have an evil character, you know, Pinky and the Brain, typical examples. But I actually quite like it when they're actually genuinely friends, and when they work as a unit. And I think probably we go straight back to one of the most obvious ones, which is from Robin Hood. And that's Robin Hood and Little John.
Yeah.
Where they're both skilled, but Robin Hood is obviously the brains of the operation. Little John is the muscle. And they're both, you know, they both contribute on both sides of the area, but that's kind of their designated roles. And from that, obviously, you get it very much in the Lies of Locke Lamora, with Locke and Jean. And I'm all over it, especially when Jean just gets tired of Locke and can just pick him up, because Locke is so small and Jean is so big.
Yeah, I think the reason it works so well in the Lives of Locke Lamora is obviously you've got Locke, who is very particularly skilled and intelligent in one way, but Jean is not stupid either. And Locke is not physically incompetent in other ways, so they sort of balance each other really well.
Because, yeah, Jean isn't as sneaky, and he's not as good at scheming, but he does have much more of a classical education.
Yeah.
He will read literature. He's better with numbers than Locke is. He can sew when Locke is not quite as good at it.
Really useful, that.
It is actually incredibly useful, especially since they spend most of their time in disguises.
Yeah.
You know, Locke does not think of Jean as stupid. But they all recognize that Locke is the schemer. He's the one who comes up with the games and the cons and the plans. And he's also the charmer. He's better at false facing than Jean is. But they play off of well of each other, because Locke is actually relatively useless in a fight, whereas Jean is actually quite fierce in a fight. Locke kind of just manages to get out of most situations through sheer dumb luck and determination, rather than any particular skill. So I really, really love that trope. And it's, you know, we see it in other examples as well. Tyrion and Bronn are actually a really nice example of it from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And Bronn isn't actually that much. I mean, he's not a dwarf, so he is physically bigger than Tyrion. But Bronn is not huge. He's the brawn because he's good at fighting, and he's a little bit of a wild card. And he is strong and smart and quick. Whereas Tyrion is obviously, again, the brains of the operation. He's the one who gives the orders, makes the suggestions, and comes up with the schemes. And Bronn sort of follows his lead for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah, it works.
But
well.
These are all relationships where they actually sort of like each other, where there is a kind of an understanding. I'm not so big on the, God, you're an idiot, but you're the, you know, you're all like, I have to use you. Which you often get with the villainous character who has the dumb henchman.
Yeah.
And instead, I just like it when there's an even balance and they understand each other's strengths. Again, Artemis Fowl, you have Artemis and you have Butler as well. Same situation. And basically, I'm aware that I'm repeating a lot of the same books said, but that's weirdly enough because I like books which have got the tropes that I enjoy.
Well, no, that makes perfect sense to me. I think I am too, to a certain extent. Okay, this one will be a bit more off the wall. Yeah. The marriage of convenience. This is my most embarrassing trope ever.
It's also incredibly funny because you're so anti-romance. It's amazing.
I really am, and I know I've mentioned this one before, but basically this stems from every so often I like to take a little break from fantasy and science fiction and horror, and I might pick up something in this vein. It has to be really well written and quite clever, so usually it's something like Georgette Heyer. Mm-hmm. And I particularly love the Georgette Heyer ones where you've got an heir and an heir who cannot come into his fortune because his elderly relatives will not allow him to have his fortune unless he marries and shows that he's more than a rake and won't just gamble and basically piss his inheritance up the wall. So he asks sort of a female friend or a ward of a local family who he's known for years and years and years, never looked at in any light like that. And she's kind of like always looked at him as kind of almost like a big brother or a friend. And she thinks, well, I'd really like to get out of being like beholden to this particular family because I'm fed up of fetching and carrying all the time. So they get married and they end up falling for each other. So it's kind of like a, yeah, we're going to get married. You know, they even start off at the beginning by saying, yeah, we'll be discreet, but we'll each go and see other people. We're literally just getting married so that we can have our independence. And it's a case of, now we're married, we kind of don't want to see other people. What the hell's going on here? It's just really cool.
Yeah. But and weirdly enough, it's a trope which has gone in, which is very popular in fanfic as well, where it's the fake dating trope. So rather than the marriage, it's the,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, we're dating. But now actually we kind of are dating.
Yeah, I mean, you get that in the anime film Summer Wars, where she's so convinced that if she goes back to visit her family over the summer, they're going to think she's a failure. So she persuades a boy who secretly had a crush on her for ages to pretend to be her fiancé. And then by the end of it, you know, they've stopped a nuclear war and what have you, as you do over the summer. And she's like, actually, you're really cool. I really like you. It's great, and it's particularly great when somebody along the way works out what's going on. It's like, you two aren't married properly, or you two aren't dating properly, are you? This is kind of an arrangement thing, and either they're really keen on one person, which causes a lot of ups and downs, or they're trying to hold it over them in order to blackmail them. That makes it especially satisfying.
You know, it's good that you're telling me all of these, because now I'm going to plan so many books.
I do like the slightly more dicey, I suppose it follows kind of the Beauty and the Beast trope, whereby I know people say, oh yeah, it's Stockholm Syndrome, and actually it's not really, if you think about it, because she was given a choice. It was a case of, you can save your family's fortune, or you can just not, you can let everything burn down around you and refuse to marry the beast kind of thing, or refuse to go and live with the beast. Yeah. So there was a choice involved. It's not a great choice, but it was still a choice.
Yeah.
So it's not nearly as rapey as people make out, but it's still not great. There's no. things like the Hollow series by Caroline B. Dunkel, where you have in the first book, The Hollow Kingdom, Marek is the king of the goblins, and you know the way the goblins look at romance is kind of like, well, is she good breeding stock or not? It's a case of that, you know, affection will follow because we treat people kindly if we're married to them, as long as they don't really fuck us over. Yeah. But the main thing is, I want my species to survive. There's no rapiness going on, I'd like to point out. You know, anything that happens, happens consensually after the new bride has been given plenty of time to adjust and what have you. But it is a case of, generally the goblins tend to abduct human wives. So that's slightly dicey to start with. But in the Hollow Kingdom, Marek goes after, I can't remember the girl's name, I think it might be Clara. I could be wrong there. And she manages to beat him at every single turn, right up until her guardian kidnaps her sister, and she assumes that the King of Goblins has taken her sister. So she walks into the Goblin King's kingdom and says, I will marry you if you free my sister, not realizing that it's her guardian who's kidnapped her sister, not her, not him.
Right.
And he does. He goes back and she goes with him, and he takes revenge on the guardian, frees her sister. Her sister comes and lives in the Hollow Kingdom as well. And in the end, she ends up rescuing the King of the Goblins because he gets kidnapped by someone who basically imprisons goblins and uses bits of them in spells. It's all very gross. But, you know, she discovers sort of halfway through, actually, I've fallen in love with this guy. I've married him out of kind of, as part of a bargain to free my sister. But despite the fact that he looks really, really strange, and we're not talking David Bowie strange, we're talking really strange, I didn't realise this, but I am actually in love with him. So I really, really enjoyed those books. But I admit that there's a wide grey area potentially in the middle of that. And some people who write these stories don't handle the grey area of consent very well.
Okay. So next one I've got, it's my last one before our conjoined one, which is the one we both really enjoy. I mean, there's several that we both enjoy from this list. This one is Humour as a Defence.
Yeah.
I am weak. I am weak for this trope, which is that you have a character who uses humour as a defence to hide their pain, to hide their trauma, or, you know, to hide whatever is going on. And it can be a jovial kind of humour, so a very obvious, a clowning kind of humour, or it can be cynicism and sarcasm instead.
Yeah.
And most of the characters that I've mentioned previously use this trope because it's an incredibly attractive one, which you do see a lot of. You see Mal Reynolds uses it quite a lot as well.
Yeah, Deadpool.
Deadpool absolutely uses it. I think an example of a character who uses it, who I haven't spoken about so far, is Klaus, the Umbrella Academy.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Because he is often saying ridiculous and silly things.
And the whole flamboyancy of him as well.
Yes. You know, he's physically very, very flamboyant. And at the same time, this is a character who is has a real drug problem, which has come from the fact that he was horrifically traumatized as a child. Thanks, Daddy Hargreaves. a real dick parent. And then, not to give spoilers, so for anyone who hasn't watched it yet, this is a spoiler. Klaus comes back from Nam, okay? He goes to Vietnam and fights for 10 months, loses the love of his life, and then comes back and just...
That was kind of the turning point for me, because I watched the Umbrella Academy basically because Madeline said, and I was just kind of like, he's kind of being a douche nozzle all the way through, and then he got to that bit and I was like, oh my god, stop hurting him!
Like, really, at this point he has been through enough. Yeah, up until that point he was just he was a likable but not a likable character. And yeah, he comes back and you see some very vulnerable moments from him, but for the most part, he just spends it. He uses humor to deflect, to the point that his humor is now so obviously a deflection that anyone can clearly see something is wrong with him. But his siblings are also concerned about other things. Very few of them notice.
I'm so not over the ending of the Umbrella Academy.
Yeah, it was certainly something. But yeah, I love it. But yeah, I particularly use it in Kestrel, the humour behind her. It is mostly a mask. That there's even a line referencing to that where they say, well, you know, beneath all your sarcasm in your cheek, you know, what's underneath it all? And she goes, nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'm just a string of jokes stitched together. You pull me apart, I'll die.
Yes. I feel... Okay, I don't know how much I can talk about it because it's not ever been released. It was done... Obviously, you've done it well enough that when I wrote bits of crossover fiction that I tapped into some of it for Kestrel's character.
Yes.
Because there is an episode with a height, which obviously Em's not great with heights. She can force herself if she absolutely has to, but it doesn't mean that there aren't sometimes when she just goes, I can't do it, I can't do it. Kestrel's kind of like, in this slightly cynical, almost like, oh, it's okay, we'll just sit here and die then. and Em sort of finally like cracks one eyelid open. Oh God, she's not fucking kidding. She's not, like, she's saying it in a jokey manner, but no, she actually means it. She is that fatalistic.
There is actually, again, another line where Kestrel, as she kind of gets a little bit worse, frequently makes jokes dying, which is a very typical nihilistic thing to do. But one of the characters starts to perceive that these may not just be jokes because he's also been through a very depressive suicidal phase. And Kestrel just makes a joke at one point, because they're all being quite mean to her, and she says, you know, one day I'm just going to disappear and you're never going to find my body. The other character just takes hold of her wrist and is like, just stay close to me for now, would you please?
Yeah.
So yeah.
So, yes, snippets of future delights, readers. Hopefully.
Future delights.
Okay, we're going to look at some, well, we're overrunning slightly, but never mind, of tropes that we both really, really liked. We both went, oh yeah, I love that trope. And the first one I'm going to mention is made in a lab or experimented on in a lab, which again... It makes us both sound utterly sick, but I love that so much. It's things like Dark Angel, where she was literally grown in a lab and it has shaped her entire life and really fucked up her life.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do like it. And yeah, the experimentation as well. Especially if they don't quite remember the experimentation and it comes back to them in flashes. I guess it's because there's I think genuinely terrifies quite a lot of people, the idea of being experimented on,
yeah,
especially while you're awake. So it's, in terms of hurting characters or creating trauma, it's right there on the bingo cards. It's fantastic.
Yeah,
you want it.
It's one of the parts of Stephen King's The Stand I really love is the fact that you've got one of the main characters, Stuart Redman, who has not developed the super flu and they can't work out why. And they've obviously taken they haven't just quarantined his entire town, they've taken the whole town over to one of the centres for disease control. And they've locked him up in a room and they've denied him information and they keep taking blood from him and trying to work out what it is that's made him resistant until literally everybody in that building dies of the super flu and he's just left there by himself with one other person who's pretty darn sick. And this other person is kind of guarding him and intends to kill him because everything is so warped at that point and society has broken down to that level where it's a case of you've got people just going through the motions trying to cover up the clusterfuck that is the someone's dropping a beaker full of super flu. And of course Stu's still alive and this guy comes in with a gun and it's all very, very tense, but it's literally one of my favourite bits of the book. Been locked up
You're
for weeks.
Sicko.
Traumatized. And I'm just like, I'm loving every minute of it. And some of my early fiction, which I don't think anybody has ever actually seen, but I've got I have a character and she literally wakes up in a lab and her first thought is, I don't know who I am. I've got no idea who I am. And you find out later that they've managed to get samples of vampire DNA and other supernatural creatures' DNA and they've grafted it to human DNA and everything's gone really, really, really wrong. And there's a massive fire and a lab breakout and she escapes and ends up somewhere else. Anyway, it's fun. I don't know. I might return to that story at some point, but I haven't looked at it for about 5 years, so I might look back at it and go, oh my God, my writing's terrible. And nobody can see it.
But we know now, Jules. We know.
Yes. That sort of scenario works really well with a dystopian or post-apocalyptic setting as well, I find.
It really does, yeah. Which is peculiar, because I don't usually like dystopian, but I must say. Oh, I'm a sick, sick woman. Should we go for a more positive one now to finish up?
Yeah, we will.
And this is the trope that Jules and I are both crazy over, and we know we're not the only ones. And that is the found family trope. Yeah. We just love it.
Yeah, it's got to be done right. But you just can't take a random bunch of characters and throw them together. You've got to like develop the characters and develop the character relationships between each individual character. They've all got to have something a little bit different. And there's got to be the pushes and pulls that there would be. But what you end up with is this sort of idealized almost family where they've all chosen each other and it's just amazing.
Yeah. And it's especially great if they're all a tiny bit dysfunctional.
Oh yeah. They're outsiders.
And you see it in very positive senses, like as Jules has said and been delighting over, I've been watching Star Trek The Next Generation. and in particular, whenever you get a crew of any kind, you know, people who have to be on a ship or in a space or even sharing, you know, a flat, an apartment, as is the case with I Rule the Night, you can get this great opportunity to create these found families where people are forced, you know, despite their differences, they all come together and then they become very, very close.
Yeah.
And you get it again, typical example, found families, of the books that we've looked at so far. Loch Lomora is right up there because they're literally a bunch of orphans who just got grabbed by an eyeless priest.
The way that they, sorry, that really fucked me off in the first book.
What? Yes.
You know what? You know what?
Yes, I do know what, but you know what? Deal with it.
You can't give me a found family and then do that. That's just, it's not on. Oh, God.
Yeah, they go through a few bumps in the road. It's certainly true. But they are found families nonetheless. They're all brothers. They're all brothers, except for the relationship, obviously, between Sabatha and Locke. Other examples, again, Six of Crows, perfect found family. We particularly love found families in YA fiction where it's our parents are useless or our parents are dead and so our friends are our family. They are the ones we can rely on.
Yeah.
You see it in The Rest of Us Just Live Here, Patrick Ness. Happens in A Court of Thorns and Roses, with pretty much the entirety of the inner circle. It definitely happens in the Unveiled series toward the end, where all I can say is that I read I Am the Silence, and I was so angry at Beth. Because I was like, you don't deserve to be Emily's friend. I sent to Jules the whole time saying how much I wanted to be Em's friend because I was so angry. To the point that I think that was the point that we actually started looking at the crossover with Kestrel because I was so desperate for Emmeline to get a better friend that I was going to introduce her to Kestrel, which is alarming because they don't get on to begin with.
No, they don't. And you're right. And the thing is, I think that is what kind of I did say to you, well, that's not going to happen in the next book, but guess what? It's going to be a quartet now. Ha, ha, ha. That didn't happen. Spoiler alert, guys. It didn't turn out to be a quartet. But maybe I can have like a decent friend for her in the fourth book. And then instead of just one decent friend, she ended up with a bunch of lovable misfits, which, let's face it, that is how I would make friends with people. I'm weird and I'm socially maladroit and I always say the wrong thing. So my only hope is to like find a bunch of lovable misfits and either go on a drinking binge or save the world. So that's pretty much what happened with Em.
Yes, it is. And it's definitely one of my favourite tropes. And it happens again in Kestrel, which you guys can all look forward to. And to a certain extent, it happens with certain groups in the Hamartia cycle, particularly with Zachary and Marcel and Emmerich, and with Rufus, Jonathan and Faye.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's our favourite, and I think that's a good place to end it on.
Yes.
Before we go, do leave us a comment and tell us what your favourite tropes are. Do you agree with us? And of the tropes that you've heard today, do you have any book suggestions we haven't mentioned that you think we're going to like based on what you've heard? Please do, because we are whores for this, okay? We are thirsty.
We are trash and for that shit.
Unapologetic about my obsession with feverish men having nightmares, having been stabbed. Okay, before we go, Jules, I believe you've got a Dissecting Dragons recommendation for us.
I have. On a completely different note, there is a Netflix series which is described as a visual anthology, so that's quite different, and it's called Love, Death and Robots, and basically it's varying length episodes, sort of between 10 minutes and 30 minutes, and lots and lots of different writers have worked on this, so you've got a story written by one writer and animated with another team, and all the way through. And the main thing is that it's something a little bit either futuristic or a little bit strange, a little bit sort of vaguely dystopian. But some of the, you know, that doesn't mean the stories are all bleak. They're not. Some of them are a bit mind-bendy. Some of them are very funny. Some of them are a bit bittersweet, and they are just really, really cool. I highly recommend people check this out. It's lots of different styles of animation too.
Well, thank you for that recommendation. And to all you listeners out there, thanks very much, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.